What I'm going to speak to you about today is a topic of the that regards the question of the actuality of Thomism, or perhaps conditions for its relevance in the Church after Vatican II. And the title of the talk is simply Thomism After Vatican II. And you'll see that one of your heroes features prominently. Although, perhaps not as overtly as you might think, but actually, we can talk about maybe in the Q&A. He's more important than you might realize in the underlying articulations. Okay. By the end of the Second Vatican Council, it had become customary for many attending the event to speak of the minority party and the majority. The terminology is employed unselfconsciously, for example, in the Journal of Yves Congar, as he writes in 1964 and 1965. Both parties, if there really were such, were no doubt each numeric minorities within the larger whole, but they represented ideological tendencies vying for influence. In retrospect, we can say that they were divided by a common question. How should the Church understand herself and her mission in the modern world, in the wake of the decline of ancient monarchical regimes and the rise of modern secular democracies? Both sides were, in a certain sense, seeking to preserve the fullness of Catholic teaching and to promote that teaching in the modern world. Both longed for the reunion of the Church with the predominant culture, but with differing points of emphasis. One tendency was to see this aim in primarily defensive terms, the minority emphasizing the preservation of authentic intellectual and spiritual traditions over and against an errant modern secularism. The other tendency, the seeming majority, was to see this aim in dialogical or primarily optimistic terms, seeking opportunities in the signs of the times for a way to bring the Church's message to modern man. Neither side in this engagement wanted to do away with the privileged study of Thomas Aquinas in the life of the Church, but they tended to envisage that study in fairly different terms. Here one might consider two of the most balanced voices, one from either side. First, then, consider Cornelius Fabro. The renowned Italian Thomistic scholar was asked to compose a votum in the early 60s as part of the Commission on Seminary Education that would eventually produce Optatum Totius, the document on the education of priests. Fabro predicted that in the coming years there would continue to develop in European civilization a post-religious subjectivism that he denoted by the term immanentism. This cultural tendency would lead to a twofold error. On the one hand, an extreme form of skeptical rationalism that takes away any appeal to absolute revelation. An extreme form of skeptical rationalism that takes any appeal to absolute revelation to be an imposition upon the freedom of human consciousness to derive for itself the content of personal truth claims. On the other hand, an extreme fideism, a theology that takes refuge in the integrity of traditional forms of thought without due reference to metaphysical realism, the philosophical study of nature, ethical objectivity, or a healthy confidence in the positive relation between supernatural faith and natural reason. To remedy this twofold tendency of modern subjectivism and ecclesiastical fideism, which Fabro warns will enter deeply into the life of future clergy as well as Catholic laity, he counsels the study of St. Thomas in both seminaries and Catholic universities, the consideration of the first principles of speculative and practical reason, study of metaphysics, and the constitution of the human person, all in Thomistic terms, knowledge of the arguments for the existence of God, consideration of the relation of creation to the modern sciences, and so forth. Second, on the other side, consider Yves Congar, Dominican theologian. Interestingly, Congar saw the council as a kind of vindication of Thomism, at least in its spirit or method of procedure. Interestingly, note that that's very different than Joseph Ratzinger, who thought that the event signaled a return to an older patristic model of engagement with culture, rather than that represented by scholasticism. They're the same side, different evaluation of the place of Thomism. In an essay in 1967, just after the council, Congar contrasted two visions of Thomism that were present at the council. One particularly focused on, to quote him, a system of abstractions and of prefabricated solutions to intellectual problems. Congar associates this form of Thomism in the essay with Billuart as a paradigmatic example. If you don't know who Charles Billuart was, he's an 18th century modern Dominican commentator in modern Enlightenment France. Inspired Garrigou Lagrange in part. He claims that it developed out of long-standing rivalries between religious orders and their theological schools, and is more interested in inter-ecclesial quarrels than in real engagement in evangelization. He's thinking of like the fights between Dominican Thomists and Suarezian Jesuits and Scotist Franciscans. Catholic intellectual life is most healthy, by contrast, he says, when it engages with the real problems of its age and helps to make the gospel most accessible to those both inside and outside the church. In other words, Catholic theology should be missionary in nature. Congar claims that the council follows the example of Aquinas in this regard, and now I quote him at some length. St. Thomas Aquinas was not a man who repeated categories and conclusions supposedly formulated once and for all. He spent his life seeking out new texts, in overseeing the production of new translations, in dialogue with all the so-called heretics of his time, those who did not think like him, either within or outside of the church. The council is right, Congar adds, that we should not repeat his theses, but rather place ourselves in his school of thought. Close quotes. In other words, we should do today what Aquinas did in his own age by engaging with the thought world and questions of our time. Now, Congar then gives a succinct list of the main theological issues of the day as he sees them in 1967. What is his list, incidentally? How should theology engage with modern exegesis? The tasks of ecumenism with the Orthodox and the Reformed? The questions posed by Marxism? Depth psychology? The birth control pill? And the atomic bomb. Now, nothing transpired after the council precisely as anyone had expected it to, and great changes occurred, but to give a partial list, 1968, the sexual revolution, the decline of religious practice in Europe and North America, and now, including that, we could say vast expanses of South America, the expansion of Catholicism in the Southern Hemisphere in places that had not previously been present, the fall of Marxism, the victory of secular liberalism and capitalism in Europe and the United States, the postmodern critique of philosophical modernity, the effects of computer technology on modern communication and the economy as it developed a global finance system, but also the pontificate of John Paul II, who offered an intellectually plausible and spiritually profound vision of Catholicism in the midst of this emergent modern world. Without seeking to evaluate here the many facets of the council and its aftermath, I would simply like to say at this juncture that Fabro and Congar are both right, but each under a different aspect. For one, Thomism is above all an integral way of seeing the world rightly. It is a science and a form of wisdom. For the other, it represents an intellectual stance of the Catholic intellectual life, a vitality of engagement with the contemporary issues of one's age, in the service of evangelization. So you have here two poles of emphasis: integrity of principles, vitality of engagement. Evidently, no opposition between these two is required, but there is the need to understand them in a proper order. Toward that end, let me reflect briefly on each point with a view toward answering the question posed implicitly by the title of this presentation. What should Thomism aspire to do after Vatican II? Now, towards the first point, then, let's consider the integrity of Thomism. What is it? First, we must say that it is simply painfully minimalistic to say that Thomism should represent to us merely the valid aspiration to do in our own time what Aquinas did in his, to create out of the dialectical web of opinions of contemporary persons that currently occupy our own cultural space a unique Christian vision. That might be an aspiration inspired by the example of Aquinas or not, but it is certainly not a stable or integral form of thought. It is nothing like the perennial philosophy that is alluded to in recent ecclesiastical documents like Optatum Totius and Fides et Ratio, and which advocate explicitly for the study and transmission of the philosophical and theological patrimony of Thomas Aquinas. On the other extreme, it seems like it is a danger to define Thomism merely by reference to Aquinas' most unique philosophical and theological theses, those teachings which set him apart even in the 13th century from his scholastic contemporaries. I'm alluding to theses like those of the real distinction between esse and essence in all created beings, a distinction so dear to Gilson as the essential determining factor of Thomistic metaphysics. Or Aquinas' particular doctrine of participation, his affirmation of the soul as the subsistent form of the body, such that the person is one composite substance composed of body and soul, his teaching on the agent intellect as the natural principle of human cognition, or in theology, his treatment of the persons of the Trinity as subsistent relations, his Thomistic doctrine of infused moral virtues, which the Franciscan school rejected, the theology of transubstantiation, as so originally and influentially articulated in the Summa, his particular theory of the character of priestly ordination, and so forth. Surely these insights are all part of the Thomistic heritage. It would be foolish to say they weren't part and parcel of Thomism. But taken in themselves, they would represent too narrow a definition, and in fact a psychologically insecure and negative one. How is Aquinas originally not like everyone else? Instead, perhaps we might say the following. First, philosophically speaking, Thomism is, broadly conceived, a Christian Aristotelianism based on the classical philosophical patrimony, even of the pre-Christian Greco-Roman world, expanded organically and developed insightfully in the light of Christian revelation. Thus, the Thomistic heritage typically transmits certain principles that derive originally from Aristotle himself and that are held not only by Aquinas but which are common to the broader scholastic community as well. For example, the epistemological distinction between the speculative and practical intellect, the study of the categorical modes of being and the four causes, the hylomorphic theory of matter and form as co-constituent principles of nature, the understanding of the soul as the form of a living body, the distinction between substance and accidents, actuality and potentiality, a teleological theory of human agency, a virtue-based account of morality. At the same time, Thomism does entail a unique account of this broader philosophical patrimony that is marked radically to its very depths by the Christian tradition and by Aquinas' original genius and insight in interpreting that tradition. Now consider in this respect the kinds of doctrines that were mentioned above, St. Thomas's metaphysics of the real distinction, his interpretation of the transcendentals, his participation metaphysics, his philosophical treatment of creation, the arguments for the incorruptibility and subsistence after death of the human rational soul, itself the subsistent form of the body, and Aquinas's own very original account of the human emotions, his theory of various moments of human free action and the treatment of moral objects, ends, and circumstances. We could continue to expand the list. It's quite amazing as a list of what Aquinas is almost unique in doing in the history of philosophy. But the main point, however, is the following. Thomism does contain, philosophically speaking, a coherent body of doctrine, an account of the structure of reality, and is at the same time well-grounded in the larger tradition of European philosophy. It cannot be reduced to a sociological motif or a merely formal intellectual aspiration. When I hear people say, let's do in our own time what Aquinas did in his own time, I feel like I hear fingernails going down the chalkboard. To understand what Aquinas is arguing about the nature of reality, one must develop a habit of the consideration of reality itself, seeking to understand if the analysis given by the Thomist tradition makes sense, is defensible, is organically unified, or not. The truth is at stake about reality, and not mere philosophical procedures, or worse, rhetorical stances that allow us to refer to Aquinas and then politely move on. And at the same time, Aquinas' thinking is rooted in a larger tradition of conversation, and I would say conservation. It does not emerge from nowhere to be interpreted only in a hermeneutic of discontinuity with his forebears. Let's make Thomism great again by slighting everyone else, including Aristotle, and moving forward. Or his successors. We have nothing ever to engage with Suarez. It's only a world of darkness. Well, there are errors in Suarez, but let's be careful. As if we had to wed some kind of stark Heideggerian meta-narrative to Aquinas, wherein everyone forgets the essential except Aquinas and some privileged modern interpreters. Now, I don't think Fabreau sins here nearly to the same extent as Gilson, but I am making a polemical point. It's dangerous when you have to magnify your mentor by diminishing everyone else, and it's not a good rhetorical strategy. It's probably not true either. Now, it's a little unfair to say that about Gilson, but he did write this way a lot in a kind of faux imitation of Heidegger, who thinks there really has been an absence of ontological truth between Parmenides and himself. And he is a brilliant man, but no. Okay. Second, theologically speaking, Aquinas' theology takes its point of departure from the teaching of Christ and the apostles as transmitted and understood by the church. Aquinas, as a theologian, is a model in his own right, as he is constantly seeking to understand the principles of divine revelation and the order intrinsic to these principles. His thought is, in this respect, both historical and analytic, biblical and patristic, but also scholastic, rational and demonstrative, and at times also very intuitive and mystical. Reading Aquinas teaches one how to think theologically. To say that Aquinas is a great theologian is not to deny that he's a great philosopher. As he himself points out, Sacra Doctrina ordinarily makes use of a number of philosophical, historical, and scientific theories that are not derived immediately from revelation, but which enter into the speculative habit of theology, just because theology can and must make use of them. A clear example would pertain to the humanity of Jesus Christ. God has become human. What then does it mean to be human? What should we believe about the body and soul of Christ, his human intellect and will, the nature of his human death and resurrection? Here, inevitably, philosophical views impact our particular exposition of the theological mystery, and simultaneously, the consideration of the mystery of God continually invites every person, qua philosopher, to adjust or rethink his or her views in engagement with Christian theology. When we speak of a Thomistic theological tradition, then we are denoting something complex. Certainly, it's a kind of robust scholastic theology, historically well-informed, at the service of the magisterium. It is affected in distinct ways by Aquinas' philosophical choices. But it's also characterized by Aquinas' distinctly theological insights and acumen. As Father Norbert del Prado, the early 20th century Dominican, made this argument many years ago in his famous work on Thomism as a Christian philosopher. Thomism as a Christian philosophy. He argued there, for example, that Aquinas' metaphysics of the distinction in creatures of esse and essence and of divine simplicity, because there is no real distinction in God, contributed in important ways to the articulation of the mystery of the divine persons of the Trinity as subsistent relations. God is simple, without composition of esse and essence or composition of any kind, and simultaneously God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And each of these persons are the one God, the Creator. Therefore, there is nothing that distinguishes the persons of the Trinity with respect to essence or existence, and each person must be considered in his subsistence to possess the simple plenitude of the divine being. Consequently, the persons are distinguished only by their relations of origin, which are interpreted in light of the processions of the Son from the Father and of the Spirit from the Father and the Son. The persons, then, are subsistent relations. Each one is from another in that he is. In all that he is. Each one is from another in all that he is, and each one contains in himself the perfection of the divine essence. The Father giving the Son to be by way of generation. The Father and the Son giving the Spirit to be by way of spiration. In his notion of the persons as subsistent relations, Aquinas offered the church, then, a particularly balanced form of Trinitarian monotheism, because he managed to acknowledge in a very profound way, simultaneously, both the absolute primacy of the divine unity and the absolute primacy of the distinction of divine persons. Arguably, this articulation of the mystery of God grounded in traditional Trinitarian dogma, deeply influenced by the metaphysics of esse and essence, has not been surpassed by any other exponent of the doctrine in the history of the Church. My point in giving this example is not to claim that Aquinas' theology is special because of his metaphysics, nor is the point to claim that all Catholic theologians need to be Thomists. To affirm that is to mistake Thomism for the doctrine of the Church, which it clearly is not. Instead, the point is simply to underscore by these limited examples that Thomism has an essence. It constitutes an identifiable intellectual patrimony, both in its philosophy and theology, that deeply affects the long-term health and stability of the Catholic intellectual heritage in the dual domains of the sacred sciences, philosophy, and theology. If Thomism has a role to play in the age we live in since the Second Vatican Council, this is clearly due to the integrity of the principles of Thomistic thought as a way of thinking about reality. All this with Cornelius Fabro and the minority governing position at the Council. Meanwhile, Congar is concerned to categorize the contribution of Thomism in terms of dialogue with the thought world of one's age. And I have recast this categorization in terms of vitality. A living Thomism must not only transmit the integral knowledge of principles, but also engage contemporary issues in the service of evangelization. Here we should be careful. Being in dialogue should not be confused with authentic vitality. In fact, dialogue is not always a sign of vitality. It's sometimes a sign of decline, decadence, and capitulation. But what Congar rightly is denoting, it seems to me, is the following. You don't win over the culture of your age unless you can solve its internal intellectual problems. Now, this includes, of course, the internal culture of the Church. At the time of the Second Vatican Council, the Church was faced by a number of important modern theological difficulties. Whether or not one is satisfied by the solutions that were offered by the likes of Henry de Lubac and Joseph Ratzinger or Karl Rahner or Marie-Dominique Chenu, whether by the Communio School or the Concilium School, it's clear that these people were trying to offer solutions. It's not enough to have all the right ideas and to harbor them defensively unless you also can communicate a renewed sense of their vitality and helpfulness in a context in which you are needed. In other words, we need articulations of Thomism sufficiently concentrated and integral so as to be real and useful, but also accessible and pertinent, evangelical and hopeful, so as to be missionary. We might argue that in the past 50 years, it has become painfully apparent that many of the influential theologies of the post-conciliar period are not today in any position to attempt to replace Thomism in the post-conciliar period as a normative guide to modern Catholic intellectual life. The theological anthropology of Karl Rahner, which greatly influenced the life of the Church in the 1970s, presumed a kind of modern European intellectual consensus, a post-Kantian intellectual culture with influences from Hegel and Heidegger. That consensus has since perished in the flames of postmodernism, aided by the rise of analytic philosophy and the return of scientific positivism, influences that don't, of course, always overlap. Students in the contemporary university do not suffer from overcommitment to the categories of an intellectually stifling classical metaphysics from which they need to be liberated by new modes of Catholic thinking. They suffer from the lack of any normative philosophical orientation or basic formation, and they are deeply aware of their disorientation. Typically, they are offered no unifying account of reality that spans across the diversity of their intellectual disciplines. They receive an education of scattershot expertise that is in no way unified across the different domains. And indeed, where would they get this unified perspective? University culture today is characteristically dominated by constructivistic postmodernism and scientistic positivism, both of which offer very truncated visions of reality, which are in fact profoundly incompatible with one another. The politics of identity and the new atheism are deeply metaphysically and epistemologically incompatible, and they coexist in the university, neither one offering any deep vision of what it means to be a person. Students often long for some way to make sense of the unity of philosophical experience so as to see how the world might have some analyzable, overarching meaning. And if they're Catholic, they want to see how the various disciplines of learning, whether scientific, philosophical, or literary, relate to the theological tenets of their faith. Strangely, in this context, the Thomism that was viewed by many as a cultural impasse at the time of the Council increasingly can be understood to be of unique relevance. Strangely, a book like Maritain's Degrees of Knowledge is perhaps of the most critical import, just in the juncture in which we live today. You don't see congregations with, 50 young seminarians and 50 young women religious that are forming in suburban America to study the theological anthropology of Karl Rahner. You just don't. I'm not saying that Thomism should be presented under a triumphalistic banner as a solution to all life's intellectual problems, or that the 24th Thomistic Theses are the ready-made response to the thought of Michel Foucault and other influential deconstructionist authors. I'm saying something more measured. In our own age, Thomism has become one of the only plausible contenders left that offers an authentic vision of the sapiential unity of human knowledge amidst the diversity of university disciplines. Politically, our situation is one of cultural disenfranchisement, to be sure. We are complete outsiders in an underground movement. We're almost literally in an underground movement right now. Frequently unwelcome in the university, including the Catholic universities, where we are often seen as the deep opponents or plausible possible rivals to the newfound spirit of openness of the post-conciliar era, whether that's fair or not. But the rivals who today are offering either the church or the modern world a plausible narrative of the intellectual life are diminishing and are not having such an easy time themselves. Embattled neo-Kantians, go to Harvard philosophy department and talk to those people about how they feel. They feel under complete assault from the scientific positivists, from the analytics philosophers who are not interested in the neo-Kantian liberal project. As a Dominican friar in the Toulouse province said in the heights of the crisis in the French church in the 1970s, during an episodic period of particular turmoil in a community chapter room, "Brothers, things are bad here, but by the grace of God, they are worse elsewhere." Only a Dominican can say something like that. If your goal is to win over the larger cultural today, inside the church or outside of it, it's not much easier today to be a Kantian or a Balthasarian or a Marxist or a logical positivist or a Derridean than to be a Thomist. In this heterogeneous landscape, this supermarket shopping place where there's no centralized thought system, there's an increasingly level playing field. And in that case, it's not bad to have Thomas Aquinas on your team. So what central issues does the Catholic Church face within our larger culture today? I've mentioned one above, which is the problem of the unity of the sciences in the modern university, the unity of the disciplines. We might briefly add a selected list of three others. First, no Catholic theology in the 20th century seriously engaged with modern cosmology and evolutionary biology. Today, these disciplines vie to stand at the center of academic culture, and those who would advocate for a militant secularism, a new atheism, commonly claim to be the true advocates of science. But at the same time, it's quite unclear within the larger university culture what philosophy might be employed to rightly interpret the discoveries of the modern scientific revolution. 20th century Thomists of the River Forest School claimed that Thomism could offer a needed grounding to the study of modern physics, as well as an appreciation of the role of evolutionary biology and psychology for an understanding of the human being, and this Thomism could still underscore the uniqueness of the spiritual principle in the human person and the importance of metaphysics and a philosophical understanding of the doctrine of creation. I'm thinking about the works of people like Benedict Ashley, but also Father Nogar, if you haven't ever heard of him, N-O-G-A-R, wrote a very important book. I think it's called The Wisdom of Evolution. Modern analytic philosophers typically want to see themselves as the key philosophers of the scientific age, but they also struggle incessantly to understand problems of causation, natural kinds, cosmic order, the unity of living forms, animal sentience, intentionality, and of course, the age-old problem, human rationality. The analytic philosophers don't have all the answers, but they're actually posing a lot of the right questions over and against some of the postmodern decadence. So there's actually huge opening there for a kind of what some of my friends who are in analytic philosophy departments call Thomistic Neo-Aristotelianism. In the spirit of River Forest Thomism, there's a wonderful opportunity for a younger generation of Thomists to weigh in on these topics philosophically and theologically for the good of the church and the health of the greater culture at large. Second, sexuality and gender. The teachings of the church that will remain most contested in modern Western culture are those that challenge directly the autonomous lifestyle changes that have emerged from the sexual revolution. Increasingly, they mark out Catholic Christians as unintelligible subjects in the modern secular state, and even as potential enemies of the state. Here we have only to name fundamental teachings that we know are frequently misunderstood or dismissed. The dignity of human life from conception to natural death. Marriage is the morally appropriate context of sexual love. The heterosexual and procreative character of marriage. The intrinsically problematic character of contraception. The celibate priesthood, the all-male priesthood. In addition, we might note the expanding set of bioethical issues where the culture embraces practices the church cannot condone. In vitro fertilization, same-sex adoption, the day-after pill, prenatal eugenics, which is going to be coming our way, I think, more and more. Such practices are becoming statistically normal. These neuralgic issues are all related in some way to the theme of sexuality and gender. They touch upon the very nature of the human person as an animal who is capable of serving God in his or her body, as an inherently political animal who is born into and cared for by a family, and as a fallen human being, in many ways wounded and weak, capable of sexual godlessness and selfishness, but also in need of mercy and compassion. We need to discuss them, but also resituate their consideration within a deeper treatment of the human person, human happiness, the virtues, our relationship to God, and the spiritual character of human love redeemed by Christ. Clearly, we cannot simply ignore such topics either individually or in our respective religious orders and hope they disappear or that someone else who is braver than us will come and deal with them. I'll just let Opus Dei take care of that. It used to be a question of how Catholic intellectuals could effectively change the dominant views of the mainstream culture by appeal to our ethical tradition, but today it's increasingly a question of whether the dominant culture will even allow Catholics to articulate and practice what they believe, and if I may be permitted to just say, increasingly also, it's a question of whether the Catholics in charge of transmitting the patrimony of the Church's teaching believe enough in and are convicted enough about and even are familiar with the teaching of the church in such a way as to transmit it. Okay. It may seem that on these difficult subjects we lack sufficient allies in the larger culture. Now that's true to be sure that we lack sufficient allies. However, the permissive world we live in also gradually gives rise to many profoundly disillusioned, wounded people who are looking for a deeper moral formation on all the controversial issues. If we provide a framework that is at once coherent and demanding, but also rationally accessible and compassionate, we will be preparing a counter-alternative to the predominant culture, a counter-alternative, a kind of potent intellectual remnant. We have at our disposal in this regard the great resources of Aquinas's account of the human person as body and soul, spirit and sense, and his accompanying teleological conception of freedom, eudaimonistic ethics, and virtue theory. Now, if this is articulated in a way that is accessible, rationally sensible, and authentically spiritual, it is powerful and compelling. Last, theology today lacks unity in the way that it explains the central mysteries of the Christian faith. Marie-Dominique Chenu sought to remedy this by referring to Aquinas' exitus reditus schema. All things come from God, according to Aquinas in the Summa, and all things return to him, and thus the prima pars shows things coming from God, and the secunda secundae and the tertia pars are about the way of return. It's a nice way of trying to unify theology in a kind of, under the banner of a kind of theology of the divine economy. It's a questionable way of reading the Summa and it's in its overarching structure, but it's not unhelpful to at least think about it, whether one accepts it ultimately or not. Chenu sought to read Aquinas so as to procure a theology of the divine economy and of human history in our age that was obsessed with historical consciousness. This is meant to provide a framework for the tasks of theology in the historically minded hermeneutical age in which we live. Theology is a kind of meta-history. That contrasts, of course, with Gary Gulagrange's much more metaphysical, you might say rationally rigorous, atemporal vision of theology that Chenu studied under Gary Gu. He did his doctorate under him, and there's a strong rivalry between the two of them at the heart of the Dominican order, which in some way remains today. Now, it should be said that historical studies in scripture, patristics, medieval and modern thought, and in the domain of Thomism itself, the historical development of Thomistic ideas, have greatly enriched the intellectual patrimony of our time. And such studies, I believe personally, are essential to a healthy theology. We don't want to reject what's good and right in the modern historical ressourcement. They give us intellectual orientation so that we perceive better the intellectual conditions of the historical time in which Revelation was composed and in which the tradition developed, as well as the intellectual landscape of our own era, to understand ourselves in modernity and in a way, of course, as modern people. All this can readily lead to speculative knowledge, however, since the recovery of the past opens us up to a principled, profound analysis of reality as it has been rightly understood by our forebears. There's no conflict between studying Aristotle or Aquinas in historical context and thinking that Aristotle and Aquinas in their historical context discovered principles that are perennial pertinence about the structure of reality that we can look to and develop historically in our own era in light of our historical circumstances. That's what perennial philosophy does. Historical study is not at enmity with speculative theology when rightly understood, but we do live in a time when the study of the structure of the mystery of the faith is itself neglected. Just what does it mean to speak about creation? It's not a throwaway word. It's hard to talk about it. And how does it relate to the modern sciences? What is the meaning of the old law as related to the new? It's a perennial theological question. What is justification, and how does it relate to merit? How ought we to understand the ontology of the incarnation or the instrumental causality of the sacraments? We can study these questions in a historical optic, to be sure, and do surveys of previous opinions throughout the history of Christianity. And we can do so in the service of a Catholic Thomistic theology as such. But at some point, you can't just study the history of opinions. You have to answer the question. And if I may say so, academic theology today is largely in the habit of not answering the questions, but of merely rehearsing the historical opinions. It's a mistake to try to overcorrect in the other direction. What we need is a historically sound approach to the Bible, the Fathers, the Medievals, and the Moderns, but one which also seeks to find the speculative theoretical answers to the deepest theological questions and to present those to persons of our time in their own historical conditions. This is especially the case when it comes to teaching seminarians, future priests, and religious, those who need grounding in authentic theology and in the contemplation of the mystery of God, which is the source of their spiritual life and the heart of their vocation. In saying this, I'm only repeating what one finds in Optatum Totius, paragraph 16, so I cite, "Ultimately, in order to throw as full a light as possible on the mysteries of salvation, students should learn to examine more deeply through speculative labor and with St. Thomas as master, all aspects of the Christian mysteries, and to perceive their interconnection." One thing we can do as a service to the vitality of theology in our own age, then, is to preserve the classical practice of theology as a scientia, as a science that peers into the mysteries of the faith. This scientific and contemplative or sapiential character of theology is most essential to the intellectual life of the church. And I would dare say that in our church today, if those who are students of St. Thomas Aquinas do not maintain this scientific and sapiential approach to theology, it simply will not be maintained. To conclude, Pope Paul VI said that in the modern age, people will believe in the gospel when they see people giving their lives for it. There can be little doubt that we live in an age that gives more importance to witness of life than to intellectual argument. This can seem, in many ways, like a fundamental problem for the revival of Thomism. Aren't we, after all, the ones who tried to formulate all the right arguments from sound, realistic premises of reason and faith? However, that may not be the case. Scholasticism was a form of thought that developed in large part in religious communities and which was employed not only to sustain the life of those communities, but also their missionary activity across the span of the world. When Franciscans were formed in the thought of Bonaventure or Scotus, and Jesuits in the thought of Suarez or Vasquez, this formation was meant to equip them to engage with all facets of reality in the religious life in Europe, in the religious life of Europe, but also abroad and on missions. What was aimed at was an integrated life of religious witness that was also accompanied by a profound, universal, speculative analysis of reality, understood in light of God, the Most Holy Trinity. That integrity of spiritual life and intellectual vision, then, is something precious in the life of the church, tremendously vibrant and increasing and incredibly fecund as Catholicism spread in the Baroque period across the world. And it must be said today, at the same time, that unity of religious life and scholastic learning is increasingly rare. In fact, today you don't see many religious communities that are Scotist or Suarezian, and there used to be. And yet, amazingly, what I am referring to in this paper does still subsist in the church, where the speculative study of Thomism can be found as something integrated within an evangelical witness of religious life. And this is true in both of our respective religious institutions. It's something of tremendous existential vitality and import in our world today, a unified life of devotion to God and of articulation of universal truths. The era of post-conciliar opprobrium regarding Thomism is, I think, now long gone. It remains. There are remnants of it. But for the most part, it's forgotten. Certainly, millennials have never even heard of it. People don't like Thomism? What is Thomism? What is the dislike of Thomism? It's a time to engage anew. Without trying to return to the now sterile debates about Thomism that took place in the immediate aftermath of the Council, our context today is different. We are called upon to serve the Church and to evangelize in a largely de-Christianized world. In this task, we as religious have a certain responsibility for the intellectual life of the Catholic Church that we cannot really delegate to others. But that responsibility is also a blessing. It has the power to shape our lives as consecrated persons in wonderful ways. It can be a source of new life within our own communities for those to whom we preach. By moving forward into the renewal of Thomism in a post-conciliar age, we should hope in the providence of God and His intrinsically effective grace, which our own intellectual tradition, as Thomas so rightly underscores. Remember the physical premotion. If we seek with God's grace to promote the wisdom of the angelic doctor, God will fructify our meager efforts. It is to us to act, then, with hope and to find inventive ways to do so, now and in the future. The revitalization of Thomism today will succeed best where it is lived out within the context of a dynamic religious life committed to evangelical preaching. First, then, integrity of the principles with Fabro. Second, the vitality of contemporary engagement with the thought world of our age. But third, and also very importantly, the aspiration to live this out within the context of a dynamic religious community life. Those are plausible aims for a living Thomism after Vatican II. Thank you.